This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age Masterclass podcast with host Ben Morse. Episode 14, 1969, Part 2 with Todd Weber.
Everybody, welcome to another action-packed episode of Marvel Age Masterclass. My name is Ben Morse. I am the former editorial director of digital media from Marvel Entertainment, current professor at UNLV right here in Las Vegas. And if you haven't heard this podcast before, welcome. I suggest going back and listening to all our other episodes. But just to give you a quick overview, this is the companion podcast to Marvel Age. Marvel Age is a podcast where the Sarcastic Four go year by year through Marvel history. They're currently up to 1969, which we'll be talking about today, and just discuss some of the most important comics to come out of the House of Ideas. Here on Masterclass, I pull one member of the four aside, and we have a little bit more in-depth discussion on the reading. Today, I have with me the illustrious Todd Weber.
I'm one of the Sarfastic Fatstic.
Thanks for not letting me get away with that.
Yeah, that's real cute. Really appreciate that.
I was hoping you were going to just fix that in post.
Oh well, I have that ability, but we'll keep it in just as blackmail.
Oh, love it. Yeah, it's pretty heavy blackmail material. How are you doing, Todd? What's going on?
I'm doing okay. Overseeing the Place to Be Nation Pop Network, not just the comics feed, but I now own the Place to Be Nation Pop feed to break kayfabe a little bit here, and getting some things in the works and trying to get you 4 to 6 shows every week here on Place to Be Nation Pop. But it's not just comics, it's music, it's movies, it's sports, it's pop culture. Lots of good things coming down the line. And I just launched a new podcast called Binge Please here on Pop. So things are busy in Todd Weber land. Yeah.
You're getting a lot more responsibilities. It's well-deserved. You do a great job. And not only with what's going on the feed, but with the website as well.
Yeah, the website's back up and running, and you can access all of our content there, and we'll have written pieces here and there, but it's just a nice online presence where you can see everything in case you've missed. If you're not necessarily a subscriber to our feed through iTunes or whatever podcasting platform you use, you can access all of them and stream them directly from the website, which is really cool. And the website looks better than ever, kind of updated for 2019.
Fantastic, man. So congratulations on all your good work. I'm glad I was able to pay you some compliments on the front end, because I'll warn you right now, I think this is going to be probably the most contentious episode of Masterclass we've had to date, based on the opinions you guys expressed in Marvel Age and my counter opinions and counter feelings to some of those takes.
Well, to quote the great Eric Bischoff, controversy creates cash.
Yeah, so, baby.
You know, let's get paid.
This is going to be the highest rated edition of Masterclass ever. Let's dive right into it, man. So you guys covered the second half of 1969. We're talking Captain America, we're talking X-Men, we're talking Avengers, and if we have time, maybe Captain Marvel. I guess we should. The movie tie-in would be pretty good, right?
Right. Even though Carol Danvers did not play a large part in Captain Marvel, but the character Mar-Vell may or may not have.
Yeah. We'll get to that. As always, I like to take on the big stuff first and eventually get to the little stuff. And I want to start with Captain America, because this is where I think our opinions diverge the most. Not surprising, because you guys did not like most of the storyline. But before we get to the stuff you didn't like, let's touch quickly on Jim Steranko's last issue as artist working with Stan Lee as writer. And what I wanted to actually ask you, Todd, because I don't think you guys addressed this on Marvel Age, do you notice a tangible difference between Steranko doing the art for another writer versus Steranko, as he was on Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., doing the whole creative process?
I do. Captain America as drawn by Steranko is definitely an improvement on kind of the baseline that we have established for the book. But it, to me, in retrospect, doesn't necessarily... Oh, what's the word? The Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff is revolutionary, and the Captain America stuff is still excellent, quite excellent, but it's not necessarily a thing where you go, oh, this changes everything. Now, this is about the highest you can get out of production Marvel Comics, no, don't get me wrong, but to me, it's not quite as essential as the S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff, but it's still beautiful to look at. The stories are still pretty good.
I think you're right. I think it's you nailed it on the head. It's the difference between very good and groundbreaking. This is high quality art, high quality storytelling, looks beautiful, still a cut above just about anything else you're going to read. But I think Steranko definitely, when he's kind of creating the boxes himself, when he's making the rules, that's where he tends to take more chances. This is an interesting combination of Stan Lee, a writer who is, at this point, you know, innovative in his own way, but definitely into a formula at this point, especially on a character like Captain America. This isn't Silver Surfer. He's not doing a lot of bold outside thinking on this one. It's really just a classic Captain America adventure. You got the weirdness in the story with the fake death and everything. I mean, really, Steranko's art is the star here. But yeah, no, not a terrible story, but not on the level of the other Steranko stuff we've read to this point.
Yeah, it's a four and three quarter star. You know, it's only only diminished just a very slight amount. Now, the reading list, and we get back to it, you know, criticizing the reading list that we're provided, only gives us one of the 1969 Steranko issues of Cap, but all three are really, really good. I think this is actually the least favorite of the three that I read. Outside of the reading list, I said I did some extra work just because those are great comics. Take the opportunity to read them. So I would still recommend reading all three of the Steranko Cap issues. They were 110, 111, and 113. And 113 is the one we're judging here. And it's really well done, this telling the story through Rick Jones' point of view at Cap's gravesite. So really cool.
Yeah, no, definitely. I echo that sentiment. I say if you're any sort of comics historian or someone looking to get an appreciation of Marvel, Steranko, honestly, his output is not that much. It's Strange Tales, it's Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., and then it's these couple issues of Captain America. So if you're looking, and obviously some great covers, but if you're looking to do a deep dive into Jim Steranko, then yeah, read all the Captain America issues. Yes.
Particularly the way his art pops very dramatically with the return of Cap on the 2-page spread. We talked about that. That's some just state of the art work, I guess. I'm not able to say it any more eloquently than that. You have the Nick Fury in a coffin, Vision in a coffin, Cap dramatically entering the scene to take on AIM in his, or I'm sorry, Hydra in his off his motorcycle. It's just awesome stuff. And imagine how that popped when you turned that page in 1969 and saw that. Oh my goodness. So again, innovative, beautiful. The story is something we've kind of seen before, but boy, I do think it's worth it just for the artwork. And you get an interesting villain in Madame Hydra too.
Yeah, for sure. I think it elevates it greatly, and I think it's a good story. That was not the only Captain America we read this month, and you guys, for this next bit, where Steranko's out, Stan is still there, joined by John Buscema and then Gene Colan, 5 issues long? I can't remember. Is it 4 or 5?
I believe it's 5. It's 115 through 119, if I recall correctly.
So we've got a story that pits Cap against the Red Skull. The Red Skull's got the Cosmic Cube. He pulls a switcheroo with Cap. So we've got Red Skull in Steve Rogers' body, Steve Rogers in Red Skull's body. Steve as Skull ends up on the Island of the Exiles, the Red Skull's old running buddies, where he meets Sam Wilson, the Falcon, and basically 5 issues of kind of meeting the Falcon and a lot of Cap Red Skull shenanigans. You guys hated this.
I think hate is a little strong a word. We were Disappointed in its mediocrity. How about that?
That's fair. All right. Disappointed in its mediocrity. So I'm going to meet you halfway on this because I enjoyed this story and I'll get into why. But I'm going to first seed the points that I think you guys are correct on. One, 5 issues was too long. Absolutely. This was not a story that needed to stretch for 5 issues. It was padded big time. Two, I think this is... The Falcon is not a very interesting character from the jump. He would develop into one later, but as far as his appearance here, don't love the visual design of his costume. Don't think he's given anything to particularly distinguish himself. And then third, I will also say to you guys, you're dead on. When John Buscema, one of my favorite artists of all time, mails it in, he really mails it in. And on this Cap issue that he draws, it's not his best work. That all said, I thought this was a fun story. And I guess what bothered me was how quickly you guys threw it under the bus because of kind of the goofy elements of it. When to me, it's a perfectly acceptable, goofy 1960s comic book. And honestly, if I read something like this today, and I know it's like the mind switches and the logic gaps and Cap using mud to disguise his face and just stupid stuff that you guys kind of harped on, and as is your right to do so, for me it was fun, it was enjoyable, it was a goofy story, but it was the kind of comic book story that I enjoy just because this stuff works in a comic. It doesn't have to take itself too seriously, and if there are some logic gaps that you can drive a bus through, I'm okay with that. I'm willing to give it a pass. That's on the story side. I do want to talk about the art side in a sec, but basically that's kind of my take on the story is, look, I don't think it was Watchmen, but I do think it's a perfectly acceptable story. I didn't find it that mediocre, and I enjoyed myself while I was reading it.
So the mask thing didn't bug you?
No. Well, when we say the mask thing, specify what you're talking about.
The body switch where Cap doesn't want to go out as the Red Skull, and then he doesn't realize that it's a mask and that he could take off and nobody would know who the Red Skull was.
I think I'll put it this way. It wasn't enough to bother me for a lengthy period. I'll buy that Cap is so kind of out of sorts due to the situation. He's just been put into the body of his arch enemy, and basically his nemesis has ultimate power. I give him a pass that it took him 5 minutes to remember that he could take the mask off.
Issue and a half, 2 issues to remember.
Well, yeah, but this is not taking place over the course of days. It's presumably taking place over the course, a couple hours. So he's adjusting to his situation. So yeah, I'm gonna give a pass on that. It was not the first thing. The first thing that was on my mind when they switched bodies was not why does he still have a mask on. It was all right. He's got to figure out a way to wrest the cosmic cube from the Red Skull. He's got to figure out a way to survive, and eventually he figures it out. Is it goofy? Yes, it's goofy. But you know what? Again, it's 1969, and we read stories about guys with magical space rings and people who dress up as giant bats. There's got to be some sort of line of demarcation where we say, like, this is acceptable by the standards of superhero.
So, continuity question.
I don't think it's yes.
Is it the perception of Captain America has changed? It's not him actually physically switching the body because of what the Cosmic Cube is doing? Or did they actually physically switch bodies?
Oh, that's a great question. What do you think?
I was reading it as though they physically switched bodies, and then later in the denouement, the way it kind of opened up, it felt like, oh no, this is the way this worked is that the Cosmic Cube is rewriting reality around you so that everybody sees you as your archenemy.
Interesting. I went with the first reading, okay. The reading you went, that they physically switch bodies, that one is in, because he does, I'll say why. Here's the evidence I'll point out is that Skull in Captain America's body, to me, does stuff that he wouldn't be able to do if he were just being perceived as Captain America.
Yes.
Like, just physically, he moved as Captain America. And I'll tell you, some of the stuff, that was probably my favorite part of the story, was Skull as Captain America. I just found it, like, in a stupid way, very entertaining. Not just that he backhands Rick Jones. Don't get me wrong. That's great. That's an all-time classic moment to be memorialized. But I love it when he's being a dick to his fans and just all this stuff. And the only thing I regret is that I almost wish this was done in a modern context, because if this was done in a modern story, Cap would have to spend the next five issues kind of, you know, repairing his reputation, which I think would be interesting to watch a public that suddenly hates Captain America. I'm sure in this next issue, it was forgotten about, but the Cap is Skull stuff I enjoyed. The Skull is Cap stuff I enjoyed. The Cap is Skull stuff is, it's the weaker part of the story. Like the Falcon stuff, all the heroic side is pretty weak, but as far as goofy Silver Age body switch stories, of which there are a million, I liked the Skull is Cap end of this. And the other thing about Red Skull that works is he's so megalomaniacal that he is his own worst enemy, and I buy that he does the stupid things that ultimately lead to his defeat. He's not a nuanced villain. This is why Red Skull is one of my favorite villains, is because he's not nuanced. He's not Magneto. He's not Doctor Doom. He doesn't have a nobility or a greater purpose to him. He's just flat out evil. And because he's flat out evil, his ego and his lack of attention to detail will often bite him in the ass. And I think that's what happened here.
There's a classic arc where they kind of revisit the body switching with it, written by Mark Gruenwald in the 80s. And, you know, I have fond memories of that. Had you read the storyline before? Do you have some kind of youthful affection for it that would make it more enjoyable to you, or elevate it more than we did?
No, I've read the first appearance of the Falcon many times, but no, my childhood reading definitely did not extend back to the Silver Age. So this is 100%, I think, just my sensibilities in giving more leeway to some of these stories. Again, I agree it was too long. I agree that the Falcon's kind of boring, but as far as the main thrust of the Cap Skull stuff, I didn't hate it. And the other thing was, I love Gene Colan's art. And you guys didn't savage Gene Colan's art. I understand what you're saying. Compared to Steranko, it's a drop-off. But I really enjoyed, because we see Colan doing usually weird stuff, whether he's doing Dracula or, like, last episode we talked about him doing that bizarre take on Guardians of the Galaxy. I like getting to see him do kind of straight-laced superhero stuff. I think it's different. I think there's an energy to it. I think he draws Cap in a very fluid, appealing way that works. So that was the other thing was, I again, John Buscema's issue was not good. But the four Gene Colan issues, I did think were pretty well drawn, and I tried to remove myself from the they're not Steranko, because no one is Steranko. Sure. And I had appreciation for those issues.
I'm going to say that this is the best Gene Colan we've seen to this point in the project. And I don't know if that's just him getting more and more comfortable drawing superhero comics, or how much he's helped by having Joe Sinnott, who is, you know, one of the classic inkers, is still alive today and doing con signings, and was kind of the Avengers inker when I was growing up. So he's a guy I've always had a fondness for, even though sometimes, especially on Al Milgram art, he tends to be a little heavy-handed with his inks, with his blacks. But I do like the way he defined Colan's art a little better here than, say, Colan looked on the Guardians book, or he's looked on Iron Man at times. So, yeah, I have no problem with the art in the second half of the story. It's not Steranko, but what is?
Yeah, exactly. So, end of the day, not as contentious as I thought it would be, but I did enjoy this story. I was reading it one issue a day, because that's how I do my reading for this podcast. I try to read one issue a day so I can really absorb it. And it worked for me. I agree with you guys on some of the low points, but I also think there are some high points to this story. So if you listen to Marvel Age and decided to skip these issues of Captain America based on the Sarcastic Four's evaluation, I'm here to tell you, maybe give it a second look. You might hate it, but you might agree with me. Who knows?
Agree to disagree, as cliched as that is.
I think that's all we can do.
And they're quick reads at the very least, too, going through this. Yep. It's just some of the exile stuff and the island tale is, I just don't know. I feel like, boy, they could have done this in 3 issues. Or they could have gone the other way and really done a long... Cause to me, if Red Skull is Captain America, there's a lot more you could do with that than we get here. So you could have done year-long arcs with that, but it's tied up pretty neatly.
I can only imagine what you guys' reaction to a year of this would have been if we had to read. I shudder to think. So let's move on to something I think we will have much more agreement on, and that is the Roy Thomas, Neil Adams issues of Uncanny X-Men included in this reading list. To me, it's 2 distinct stories. I mean, well, obviously it's 2 distinct stories. You've got a Sauron two-parter, and then you've got a Magneto in the Savage Land two-parter. They're very different. They do have a similar feel, and we'll talk about Neil Adams in a second because obviously that's the big thing we need to touch on. But story-wise, I felt like it was night and day because I was not into the Sauron story. I was in it for the art, and Sauron, I think, works for me as a villain because of his visuals and because Neil Adams is drawing him. But I found all the stuff with the kind of Jekyll and Hyde persona and the energy vampire stuff and the, tragic love story and the overbearing father. It was all just like, it was very cliched to me. I didn't so much into the Sauron stuff outside of being like, I like seeing Neil Adams draw dinosaurs and pterodactyl men. That to me was the appeal of it. I was not as high on the story end of this as I think you guys were.
I think it was just refreshing to get Roy Thomas's voice on this. And to me, it felt almost like a Man Bat type story or, stories that we've seen done perhaps better. And I'd say maybe my favoritism of the Sauron arc is because I really, really love the Sauron Michael Golden stuff that we get in Fanfare and the John Byrne Sauron stuff. So he's been used better than he was initially used, but it's not about the story per se for me on this one.
100%. 100%. The Michael Golden Marvel Fanfare stuff, that's when Spider-Man goes to the Savage Land,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
That was when you guys were on Marvel Age and someone was saying like only the X-Men ever go to the Savage Land. That was the first
story.
That was the first story that popped in my head. I was just like, oh, there's such a great Spider-Man story where he, and I think he's been to the Savage Land a couple times, but I do know that, yeah, obviously Savage Land is primarily, the X-Men seem to find it more than other heroes. Although there's some great Avengers stories there too. There's one where they fight Terminus in the Savage Land, which is pretty fun. I think it's from the Roger Stern era, but I digress. Sauron doesn't do much for me as a villain. I agree with you. He's better served later on. And also surprisingly well drawn by a number of artists. And I credit that to Adams just coming up with a great design that other people are able to ape. You mentioned Michael Golden and John Byrne. I'm thinking all the way to his X-Force appearances in the 90s where Rob Liefeld, who love him or hate him, can actually draw a decent Sauron. So I think that speaks to, the strength of what Neil Adams can do.
An anthropomorphic pterodactyl. I bet a lot of artists would really chomp at the bit to take that opportunity and put their love into it. So, yeah, I also went back and reread the entire run of where Adams comes onto the book, which
I think that's something I'm gonna go do. I was thinking about doing it when I was listening to you guys. I really want to go back and read it in its entirety.
With Sentinels and the, who's the Pharaoh? Is that his name?
The Pharaoh?
Yes. And then you get the introduction of Havoc, and that's always been something I mark out for. Havoc is one of my favorite characters. So, yeah I just look at the whole, it's so much better than almost everything else we've read to this point that I would want to own this permanently in hardcover form.
Well, the Sauron stuff didn't hit me particularly. I'll say this. The Sauron stuff didn't hit me, and it was almost entirely because I didn't dig Sauron. I thought he was a weak villain. Good visual. I see the Man-Bat comparisons, but I agree with you that Man-Bat has been done better as Man-Bat. That said, once they move into the set, I am all in. I think, to me, and I want to read the Sentinel stuff because I want to see where it falls on this line, because the Savage Land stuff with Magneto, with the mutates, with Kazar, even with all this stuff, I was like, they're handling this masterfully. This is so engaging. I love, you guys already discussed it, so I won't say too much time on it, but I love the reverse reveal of Magneto. Helmet on, so inventive. And I think what you were saying earlier about Roy Thomas finding his voice, this is where I saw the Roy Thomas who I kind of grew to love on books like All-Star Squadron, Infinity Incorporated, Avengers even. He will get better on Avengers. I think you're right, though. I think this is him finding his voice, because those first few years of Roy Thomas are not Roy Thomas. It's Roy Thomas doing a Stan Lee impersonation.
Yes.
And that, to me, I guess that's where the Sauron story landed for me. I was like, he's still doing a poor man Stan Lee when he's writing Sauron's dialogue. This feels like a Stan villain. But ironically, with a Stan-created villain, Magneto, the Savage Land stuff, he just opens it up. And I feel like also, and again, I want to read the Sentinel stuff to see where it stacks up, but to me, it feels like by the time they get to the Savage Land stuff, Roy Thomas and Neil Adams are so comfortable with each other, it feels like, that they're really hitting on all cylinders, creating some good stuff. And they're not done either. After they're done with X-Men, they do another collaboration that I'm hugely fond of that we'll get to in future episodes.
Yeah, we're all looking forward to that. And it's very topical right now, so.
Yeah, very topical. But I just, we'll talk about the art in a second, but just to wrap up on the story, I just want to say, like, the Sauron stuff wasn't for me, but the Savage Land stuff, I agree with you. Some of the best stuff we've read to this point.
Yeah, I mean, even if you just look at the Sauron art, it makes it a cut above. But the story stuff he's doing, that Magneto reveal, like we talked about, is all-time kind of surprising moment in comics.
Tremendous. If I had been reading in the moment, I can only imagine how cool that would have been.
Yeah, it would have broken my internet.
Yep, for sure.
I like what he does with Angel, development-wise. I feel like this story era of X-Men was cut so short, and it ends in 1970. I could have seen these characters develop more and be told in more of a contemporary manner than we get leading up to this. This was such a dynamic change. I wish it could have gone on a lot longer than the 8 issues that we got. Not even, is it Kazar or Kazar pronunciation, Hero?
I always say, because that's how they said it on the animated series, which is my guide for how they character names.
Okay, and the animated series end up having a lot of sway. I mean, they changed the symbiote back to symbiote because we had a precedent established there. So Kazar is generally kind of a mort of a hero, but Neil Adams gets to do his Tarzan thing a little bit here, and that's pretty cool too. What do you think of the mutates?
I always thought the mutates were fun because, I mean, again, they're largely visual creations because Neil Adams is going to work on them. I've always loved Brainchild. I think he's just a great, whiny villain. Some of the rest are less memorable, but they're fine. They're good Magneto henchmen. They're not going to be able to carry the story on their own. You definitely needed Magneto there as the big bad. If we had had the mutates as the principal threat, I think we would be talking about a different kind of story. But as far as, being decent henchmen, I think they're competent. Something interesting you touched on that I want to talk about for a sec is the interesting thing is if you think about kind of the iconic portrayals of the X-Men, of the original X-Men specifically, so much of it comes out of these 8 issues. Because obviously a lot of the other later X-Men are going to be defined by the work Chris Claremont does. But when it comes to Beast, I'm thinking in particular, Angel, Cyclops is a competent leader, Jean kind of stepping up, and even Bobby, who probably had the most personality up to this point, they were kind of ciphers in the first few years of their existence. I don't think Stan ever found a fun voice for a lot of these characters, but the voices they find here, this is kind of the X-Men we know as far as the originals. This is definitely the Beast we know, the Cyclops. And I think it's interesting how influential, like you said, this only runs 8 issues, but it's hugely influential on how future writers are going to use the original cast.
And, you know, you feel like Roy is doing a lot of, I mean, he's closer in age to these characters than Stan is. And so, you know, go ahead.
Just saying, it shows.
Yeah, it absolutely shows in the dialogue, in the energy, in the way the characters interact with each other. So, yeah, I think it's just a ideal fit for Roy Thomas at this point. And, you know, we'll see him bring this dynamism to – that's not a word.
I'm not sure it's not a word.
Okay. I think we'll see him bring this particular energy in the years to come in some of Marvel's flagship books, and not have it be kind of wasted or squandered in X-Men, which was just not selling very well at this point.
You know, the other interesting thing about Roy Thomas is he's such a – and you'll see this again and again in his work. You'll see it in his DC work that I mentioned. You'll see it in Invaders. But he's such a big fan of these Golden Age characters and concepts that a lot of times you get Roy Thomas writing these big, epic, heroic stories where the heroes are heroes and the villains are villains and there's not a lot of complexity. What's kind of cool – with his X-Men run is you do get to see a more nuanced and layered Roy Thomas. So he was definitely capable of it. I think, yeah, and we will see him carry it over to some of the bigger books. But X-Men, you're right. It was the perfect book for Roy Thomas. Give him a young, incredibly exciting artist. Give him a cast that's pretty underdeveloped, but also somewhat close in age to him. And it really sings. So, well, I dogged on the Sauron story. I think that this Savage Land story is just top-notch stuff, and Roy Thomas deserves a lot of credit. Though as much credit as he does deserve, we got to give more credit to Neil Adams.
Yes.
The stuff Neil Adams is doing. To me, the Neil Adams stuff we read for 69, head and shoulders above the Steranko stuff. And that might be controversial to say, but I think, as you and I discussed, Steranko doing Stan's script is not peak Steranko. It's just still very good. Adams with Thomas, I think this is peak Adams. And I think that's a huge compliment, because this is like some of the first work he ever did. He comes out the gate just strong as hell. His panel layouts are incredible. His dynamics are incredible. The angles he chooses, the way he's able to marry, especially in the Sauron story, kind of a horror sci-fi vibe with superheroes. It's incredible stuff. It's really top-notch, cut above stuff.
And like Steranko, you know, he's thinking outside of the box. You're seeing panel variations. You're seeing things you'd never seen in comics before. Also, you've never seen this level of photorealism in comics before. Faces look like they're traced photographs sometimes, and they're not.
Yep.
I mean, I've seen Neil draw. He does not trace. It's amazing that he arrived fully formed, because he was so consistent for years and years. And even, you know, you see this in his, what was his company that he had in the early 80s that had Miss Mystic? His art.
I want to say, was it First?
First Comics, Comico. Yeah, something. The artist still looks like Neil Adams in 1969, in 13 years later. That seems like a much longer span, from 69 to 82, 83, but unbelievable artist, probably my favorite of the Silver Age artists we've encountered. And without this arc, would we have John Byrne?
I don't know. Yeah. It's a good point. Byrne does very much come from that Neil Adams school. And the interesting thing too is, up to this point, you kind of had Kirby and guys who drew like Kirby.
Notwithstanding Ditko. Ditko was his own.
I was going to say, you occasionally get the Steve Ditko, who's an outlier, but you had a lot of Kirby clones. Even Steranko, as unique as he is, I'll say I think he owes something to Kirby. Like, there is an influence there. He just took it to the next level.
Yeah, the tech stuff. Yeah, sorry to interrupt. Yeah.
Oh, no, go ahead. But Neil Adams is his own guy. Like, this is, there's no, I'm sure he had influences, and I would be curious to know who they are. But it feels like, to your point, he's creating something wholly new and inspiring a new generation in his own right.
I know he came from the advertising world, so just having a different perspective, you know, not just drawing a script, but maybe trying to tell a story and then adding the script to it. I think I had a couple IPAs when I made the proclamation that the Bronze Age actually starts here, but
yeah, that was that.
But I'd say
that proclamation though.
Pre-Bronze Age, or just this is where the Bronze Age came out of, this stuff. And literally, Neil Adams in Hard Traveling Heroes, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, got to be the engineer for that. So,
yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think we could talk for a whole podcast about Neil Adams. It was kind of cool to get Steranko and Adams in the same episode just because they are both so groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. But really good stuff. And, yeah, Uncanny X-Men. So you already went back and read the Sentinel issues?
I did. When I saw that these were on the list, I just said, well, it's not going to hurt to have a little bit of background on it. And so I read from 56 all the way to the end of the year to 63, the end of the Savage Land. And then he gets one more issue in 1970, and I hope we cover it, but I don't know if we will.
We'll see. But yeah, revolutionary stuff, incredible. And the start of the X-Men being at the forefront of exciting stuff
right.
in the Marvel Universe. And we'll see more of as we move forward. So that's kind of cool.
Have you ever read the X-Men The Hidden Years?
I've glanced over it because I know it's basically Byrne picking up from this era, this story, and basically saying, what if the Thomas Adams run had continued? I've read some of it. It's not Byrne's strongest work, not trash either. It's definitely a fun read, but it's interesting seeing him try to play with some of these dynamics that are on display here.
Yeah, I like to treat them like Uncanny X-Men 67 through 94 or 93.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's fair. How high up in the numbering did he make it before he got canceled?
I think it was the high 20s, so not quite there, but you could still think close. Of it that way. Yeah, and because
all the way to that.
X-Men became a reprint series from 67 until 93.
They should have numbered it that way when they were doing Hidden Years. They should have just called it they can still call it X-Men The Hidden Years, but it should have been like, you know, number 68 should have been the first issue.
Marvel of today would with their legacy.
Yeah, Marvel of today 100% would. I guess, yeah, this was a little before the innovations. Innovations is a kind way to say it, but the gimmicks that we see today.
So, yeah, highest rating. I love this so much, and I'm really glad we got to delve deep into it.
Yeah, me too. So let's move on to the other big Marvel team, and that is the Avengers, who we've made no secret of kind of bagging on to this point. There have not been good Avengers stories, and God knows we've had to read a good amount of Avengers stories. They've been pretty tame up to this point. We got two here. First, starting out with a two-part Ultron story. Two parts, right?
I believe so.
Okay.
I'm referencing now. One thing I wish we could change about Marvel Unlimited, which is how everybody should be accessing these stories, is that your settings should stay the same. If you are sorting by oldest publication date, it should stay that way the next time you're sorting or looking at a different book. But you can't do anything about that anymore.
Agreed. But it's hard to fault the award-winning Marvel Unlimited.
It's the best service of its type, bar none.
Absolutely. So, two-part Ultron story. First part drawn by Barry Windsor Smith. You guys had some pretty opinionated thoughts. I enjoyed it because it was goofy. It's not not Barry Windsor Smith of Weapon X days. It's not Barry Windsor Smith of Life Death days. But it's interesting seeing him. He was kind of doing a Kirby knockoff, and it was interesting to see him try to do it. End of the day, I get where you guys are coming from. Visually, it's not the most coherent story. Sal Buscema picks up for the second issue, greatly improved. But I'll say this, man. I'm with whoever said it on Marvel Age. I'm not that into Ultron at this point in the game. I think cool design, looks neat. You would think that the connection to Hank Pym and Vision and all this stuff, like all these interpersonal ties, would be cool. But for some reason, they feel like a handicap to me. He just seems like he's not as tough and scary as a killer robot should be, because he's really kind of this whiny kid who's rebelling against his dad. And I get that that's the angle they were going for, but it doesn't really work for me.
I'm going to fault the imagination of what artificial intelligence could do in the 60s for part of that. Mm-hmm. You know, you keep Ultron on a limited scope. Here he's just a revenge robot at this point, and not necessarily the AI savior that you see him used as in the Stern Avengers and much later the Busiek, the best Ultron story there ever was.
And Ultron Unlimited.
It's the best. I'm sure they've done other ones since then, but the Ultron Unlimited during the Busiek Perez is like the cream of the crop for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you 100%. When I think of an Ultron story, I think of the Busiek Perez run. They mastered it, and they managed to use the Hank Pym stuff, but not beat you over the head with it. It works. It's subtle. It's great. It's scary. So obviously, I can't wait until we get to the Busiek Perez era and we get to reread that stuff and you and I and Tim get to counter Nick's takes on it. That'll be a lot of fun, but we're not there yet.
No.
Yeah, I think Ultron, like a lot of these early Avengers villains, they didn't find footing. I think you actually nailed it when you said Roger Stern's the guy who's going to figure out a lot of these villains. We'll also see how guys like Jim Shooter and Steve Englehart do. But yeah, not the strongest stuff. This two-part Ultron story, it didn't really sing to me, and it was more of not the best Roy Thomas that we've seen.
But it's not necessarily stand clone Roy Thomas either.
It's true. Fair.
You know, he's done things with the characters you wouldn't necessarily expect. You're on Hank Pym's third costumed identity at this point. You're on Hawkeye's second. Still trying to find ways to make that character work. You know, try a different gimmick, get that character over. What did you think of Goliath 2?
I was never a fan because, like you guys said, Hawkeye's great on his own. He's the world's greatest archer. It doesn't make sense that you want to do something else. Counterpoint, I did like – it wasn't in these issues, but I have read some of these older Avengers issues that it was because of his inferiority complex that he did it. And that's decent motivation. Like, I understand you're a guy with a bow and arrow on a team with gods and super soldiers. Obviously, you're kind of grasping at what can I do to stand out? And the Pym particles give him a way to stand out. But yeah, man, I'm a fan of Hawkeye as Hawkeye. I don't want to read Hawkeye as Goliath. I think it makes him much less interesting. And we already had one uninteresting size changing character in the Avengers. Giving Wasp a pass and saying she's interesting. But yeah, we already had Hank Pym. I don't need a Hank Pym clone in terms of powers and costume.
And Hank Pym himself is still not interesting enough to me, and maybe that's why the Ultron thing doesn't work. Although Yellow Jacket, I didn't know Yellow Jacket existed all the way back to 1969. I thought that character was more of a 70s Englehart era character. Quite the MacGuffin. No. Yeah, Deus Ex Machina in this issue too, and then the thou shalt not kill thing, which is just a little silly.
Yeah, the less said, the better. It was it definitely grown to a conclusion. This story.
Let's talk about Salazar a little bit, though.
Yeah, let's talk about Salazar. I actually, you know, it's interesting. I don't want to break Russell's heart here, but but here we go. I like Sal's stuff from this era, from the 60s, better than his 90s Spider-Man stuff.
Yeah.
I think this is way stronger. I think he's a much more well-rounded, dynamic artist doing this Avengers stuff. He really it's the best looking Ultron we've seen to this point. The Avengers look great and the action's great. And it carries over into the next story. Some of this early Spider-Man stuff I dig, but definitely by the time I was a kid reading Spectacular Spider-Man, I thought his faces were too exaggerated. Just putting like the scowls and the wrinkle lines on it was too much. So again, I'll do apologies to Russell, but I thought this was probably some of the better Sal Buscema stuff you're going to see.
Yeah, you never forget your first. I think I overrate guys like Pat Broderick for that reason. Mm-hmm. The Firestorm comics I used to read, but I got really lucky. I got really lucky because George Perez was one of the first artists I noticed, and George Perez at any era is outstanding stuff. But yeah, I'm with you. I kind of like this artwork better than the Sal we got on books like Spectacular Spider-Man, Defenders. Maybe when he was trying to be a little bit more contemporary with the sharp angles and straight lines, it's not necessarily my thing, but I don't fault Russell for loving it.
No, I don't fault Russell for loving it either. I think much like a Herb Trimpe, I think Sal was a guy who tried to keep up with the 90s artists, and to me he would be better served just being himself, which I think is what we get here.
After Ron Frenz came on to Amazing Spider-Man, you saw Sal change his art just a little bit. And I think that was kind of a new thing for him, and I like the old Sal.
I don't think he needed to change. I'm with you. He continues on to this next story, which you guys all loved, and I'm going to agree. I love the Squadron Sinister story. I'm a huge fan of Squadron Supreme. Much like Tim and I may have to do a pod blast on that series once we get there, if we don't read the whole thing.
It's a great idea.
The Squadron Sinister, what a fun idea. And here's where you get to see Roy Thomas like just being inventive as hell. And here's where you get to see fan Roy Thomas kind of married perfectly with professional Roy Thomas, because it's a great story, but he's definitely tapping into the fact that you can tell he loved these DC characters. He had a blast writing them. His takes on them are great, though. But I love that the Squadron Sinister they're evil versions of the Justice League, but they're just far enough left that they're interesting. Like, it's not a word for word clone. I think you guys talked about the Assemblers or the Justifiers or whatever they're called in the DC universe. Those guys were more, it was just a straight up pastiche of the Avengers characters. With a character like Hyperion or Nighthawk, there's enough nuance, there's enough difference that it's interesting to read them, and it's fun to watch them go up against the Avengers. And I think that's why Squadron Supreme has endured as long as it has, in part because, Mark Gruenwald's going to write an incredible 12-part story with them, but in large part, too, just because the DC characters were starting points for them, but it wasn't the entire character, if you know what I mean.
And it's subtle enough that you don't even think about the DC thing for a while.
Right.
Especially if you're at this time, until it hits you over the head and they go, oh, well, of course it's intentional.
Right,
but it's really cool. It's kind of the Shyamalan moment for you. You see it, but Roy's doing great things with these characters and their personalities too.
Yeah.
I am not a fan of the JMS Squadron Supreme.
Nor am I.
So
yeah,
It was kind of a missed opportunity for me, but I do love this introduction to them, and I love what Jason Aaron's doing with them right now in the pages of Avengers. So, yeah, really glad that we got to check this out. And again, I didn't know it came out this early in the run. We'd been out for 8 years at this point, but.
And once again, there's a classic Busick Perez story with the Squadron Supreme as well. And we can say that about just about any Avengers character. There's a classic Busick story, but we'll get into that down the line. But yeah, this was a lot of fun. I echo you guys' sentiments that Hyperion's origin is fantastic. That he's from a microverse that was destroyed when someone split the atom. Brilliant. Just such a good twist. And obviously Nighthawk would become an enduring character. The Wizard's still around as Speed Demon. showing up in the pages of Amazing Spider-Man to this day. And Dr. Spectrum, well, poor Dr. Spectrum. Alas, poor Dr. Spectrum. He was the only one who didn't really really carry on.
Yeah, but they tweaked story, him quite a bit.
Yeah, good to see the Avengers picking up steam. And again, as we've been kind of alluding to this whole time, we're about to the question. Yeah, man, we know Nick Duke has been continually asking the question, when does Avengers get good? Well, I'm not sure they get permanently good for a little bit, but we are on the precipice of what I would consider the first truly great Avengers story. It's coming up in the next couple of years, right?
It's, I believe, starts in 71, if I'm not mistaken. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, it'll be fun to revisit there and kind of see where Avengers starts to get its footing. Speaking of things that never get their footing, let's wrap Captain Marvel. Captain Marvel, we get one issue. The reason we're showing this issue is because it's when he gains Rick Jones as kind of his Shazam-esque alter ego. As we've covered many times, Rick Jones is terrible until Peter David writes him, so this is no fun. We do get to see him backhanded by Captain America again, which points for that. Good stuff about this issue of Captain Marvel is he has an awesome costume now. Probably a better costume than the character deserved, because I think he is by far the dullest and most boring of the Silver Age Marvel pantheon, but somehow he gets a cool costume. Not much beyond that, man. This is Roy trying and not quite succeeding. And as you guys said on Marvel Age, it is not artist Gil Kane's best work.
No, but it's the first thing of Gil Kane we've seen here in Marvel, at least on these reading lists. So, and you know, it's Gil Kane right away.
Oh yeah. No question. It's Gil Kane, but, yeah, not his best effort. To me, Captain Marvel, not an interesting character. Ironic to say that on the eve of the movie, and now Captain Marvel being hugely successful, but again, that's Carol Danvers. The original Captain Marvel, to me, he is the Barry Allen of the Marvel Universe, kind of milquetoast character who worked maybe for a second in the Silver Age, but by the time they got to the 80s, the best thing they could do was give him big heroic death, and that was where he was best served. Obviously, Barry has since come back and been kind of reinvigorated, in large part because, as you and I talked on our pod blast a while back, they gave him a lot of Wally West characteristics. But Captain Marvel, dead to this day, and with good reason.
Yeah, no doubt. Although, were there not a copyright battle, or Marvel had fought so hard to secure that copyright, would there have been a Captain Marvel book at this point? You know,
yeah.
Are they just writing the book to the title character's name?
Makes a lot of sense. It's as good an explanation as any for where the hell Captain Marvel came from and why he never really popped. But on the horizon for Captain Marvel, we do have a creator who's going to do some pretty fun stuff with him. And yes, that's not far off either. Someone who really is going to reinvent the Marvel Cosmic in the same way that Steranko carved out the Marvel espionage universe. So something to look forward to.
Yeah. You know, I do kind of think the Negabands concept is perhaps an improvement.
Sure.
You know, there's interesting things you can do, and boy,
yeah,
Peter David did a great job with that when he took over the Genisville, or Genus. I don't know how you pronounce it.
Yep.
That aspect of
it. He's never been on a cartoon. I don't know.
Yep. So,
but yeah, no, there's,
the best thing coming out of this is the costume and the Nega Bands, I think. And
yep,
that's all there is to say about that.
Yeah. Stuff that'll be better utilized down the line. But yeah, that brings 1969 to a close. Pretty important year, just in terms of just the Neil Adams and Roy Thomas stuff alone. Roy Thomas finding his voice, Captain America, the Steranko stuff, and then a lot of the stuff we talked about in part one, whether it's Kirby and Lee winding down on Thor, the socially relevant Spider-Man issue. We saw just a lot of important stuff in 69. So as we head into the 70s, this was a big year to end on.
This is probably my favorite year to date, just the kind of the breadth of stuff we got to talk about, specifically the artists. See, we have so many different artists looks coming out, and you know, you're getting characters and concepts that have been around for a while that they're finding new ways to make interesting, specifically the X-Men. So
yeah,
I really liked 69, the year.
Yeah. The year. Good stuff, man. And yeah, so on we go into the 70s, and I'm excited. I think Marvel in the 70s is definitely a blind spot for me. I've read some of the 60s stuff before, just because I think, you know, when anyone dives into Marvel Unlimited, they tend to gravitate towards that early FF, that early Amazing Spider-Man. But the 70s, you know, I've certainly read the X-Men from the 70s, but not a lot else. So
original I'm Clone excited. Saga.
Yeah, I'm excited to see where the flagship books go, but I'm also excited to check out some of the fringe stuff that I've never read. I think this will be, you know, as our experiment continues, it's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how much of the weird stuff that Marvel does in the 70s, the ducks and swamp monsters and werewolves and all the classic monsters that you get. I wonder, just because a lot of Marvel's energy started going towards licensed characters in the 70s, are we going to see the prestige creators on their core books?
Mm-hmm. So we'll see. No, it's true. It's a lot of interesting stuff to go with. Well, that brings us to a close on this one, Todd. You talked about a lot of your projects at the beginning of the show, but do you want to give some love to anything else as we're headed out?
Well, of course. We've had a busy week here on the Place to Be Nation pop feed. We've got something for everybody. We had my aforementioned Binge Please podcast last week. We've got a new Songs with Friends talking about Guns N' Roses. Great debate talking about lots of different things. We got NBA Team podcast. Hard Traveling Fanboys are celebrating Captain Marvel Month. And just this past weekend, St. Patrick's Day weekend, we had them drop a review, feature-length review of the new Captain Marvel movie. So check that out, and especially if you have seen it, because it is a spoilery one. Plus, there's all kinds of great shows here. We did start the Candy Sweet 16 tournament. It's the Sugar 64 round right now. Sweet 16 is coming next weekend. So lots going on in Pop Feed, and then Wrestling Feed on Place to Be Nation is doing great, too. Great weekly shows, Place to Be Nation podcast, Wrestling War Zone, and What If. We should talk about What If, because Marvel will be doing a What If series eventually, and we'll be talking about that here on this show. So we've got a wrestling What If. So the first one was, what if Flair jumped from the WCW Turner to WWF in 1988 as opposed to 1991? What would be different? So, and that's actually done by the Hard Traveling Fanboys, bringing their comic expertise, comic knowledge, and moving it into the wrestling world. So great stuff. Subscribe to both our feeds.
Great concept for a show. And then also social media, Todd, where can we find you?
I am at Guitars of Green on Instagram and at Todd Weber Guitar on Twitter.
And unlike some other members of the Sarcastic Four, you and I are able to coexist nicely in the social media realm and encourage each other rather than cut each other down.
Now we are. That hasn't always been the case.
That's true. We're good now. We're good.
We're good. We have an understanding.
And as far as social media, you guys can find me on Twitter as Ben J. Morse and on Instagram at BenMorse882. And that's all I've got to say, man. I'm going to head in out of this hot Las Vegas sun and try to get some shade. You have a good rest of your day. All right, Todd?
Yeah, and thanks for having me on the Masterclass.
Always a pleasure, sir. And until next time, class dismissed.
registration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wingbar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.